Grade 6 Conference, Lecture 44. Why teach Rome? The answer to this question, as it's given in most 6th grade conferences and in most of the things that you find written in Waldorf literature about grade 6, is, well, the 6th grader is coming down onto the earth, standing solidly, coming into his or her bones, and the Romans also were solid. They really came to earth and landed solidly and stayed there. And that's that. There's truth to that, but as we'll see, actually, the opposite is just as true as well, that the Romans in many ways were a very disincarnate group of people. Of any major civilization, let's say compared to the Greeks who came before them, they were incredibly superstitious and incredibly nervous about what they felt to be the powerful influence of a host of spiritual and elemental beings all over, all around them. The Greeks were far more rational in their approach to things. So in that respect, there was not a lot of solidity there as at all. What we have, we might say, is that in grade 5, where, as I said last year in the grade 5 conference, the child is, in essence, becoming Greek, because the Greeks had this wonderful balance of the etheric and physical forces. The Greeks, more than any other people before or after, had this tailoring of the etheric body to the contours of the physical body, which resulted particularly in their remarkable contributions to sculpture, as well as their architecture. The Romans represent, as a people, as a whole civilization, the onset of astral forces, which push away, run roughshod to some extent, over the etheric physical balance and create an imbalance. The Romans are seeking for balance, but they are always falling out of balance, just the opposite of the Greeks. And whereas in grade 5, we have this wonderful rhythmical quality, so in keeping with the child's experience of the etheric, so healthy for the etheric, the rhythmical quality of incarnation and excarnation represented by successive civilizations. We have the excarnated quality of ancient India, followed by the incarnated quality of the Persians coming to earth, working on the earth, followed by the more excarnated aspect of the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, though there are variations within those civilizations, but particularly the strength of the Egyptian connection to the world after death, recognizing that on the earth we are apart from Isis and Osiris, after death we join them and a host of other gods and goddesses. And then finally at the end, the wonderful physical etheric balance of Greece brought about through the rhythmical interplay of these cultures, these civilizations. In grade 6, we have the astral picture, which is not rhythmical. It's arrhythmical in many respects, but as I've said before and will say again, it's polarized. The astral body is about polarities, opposites, finding at times an entente cordiale, but often resulting in inherent contradictions, in endless conflict. And we'll see how this plays out in almost every aspect of Roman life, in every detail. So the aspect of the solidity, the concrete, the Appian Way, the big, heavy pillars and all of that, That's true. That's a kind of outer picture of Rome. And yes, it is good for the sixth grader to experience that. But it is there as an anchoring device. It's there because the Romans were so astralized, were so out there, and were always trying to unite themselves to hold on like a drunkard to a lamppost, hold on to those big, massive structures and buildings to reassure themselves that they still were connected to the physical world because their astral bodies were just pulling them hither and thither. And when the astral body is especially powerful, what happens is that the mediating capacity of the etheric body cannot fully function, and you get the tendency of rigidity. You get sclerosis. Sclerosis often comes from the astral body being far too strong. So there's this sclerotic quality of Rome as well, and that again is part of this hardening and this massive love and use of stone everywhere, and even inventing something new in the mineral world, the use of concrete, of cement. So this is also essential for us to realize that there are these very powerful hardening forces, which indeed, Steiner tells us, bring the earth itself to a degree of hardening and sclerosis which is almost irredeemable. There's a possibility that the earth cannot be brought forward into a new kind of growth, into a new step, that evolution could come to an end. Rome represents this, and Rome is partly the cause of this. The Romans exemplify this hardening of the earth more than any other culture. So it's significant, it's not a coincidence then, that Jesus of Nazareth would have to find his way to a Roman-occupied province. He would have to be part of the province of Judea so that he could experience this hardening of the earth. And we'll see then why it is so apt and so essential, really, for Jesus and his life to be brought into the grand tableau of Roman history. Another aspect of the teaching of Rome is cultural. I could even say patriotic in a certain respect. In 1919, when Steiner introduced the Waldorf curriculum, even after the carnage of World War I, Europeans still felt a kinship, a strong connection to the life of Rome. We might say, well, that was there. What about the United States? Things are a little bit different, but still, I grew up in the 1950s in New York City. Every single bank branch that I ever remember walking into, way up until my late teens, looked like a Roman temple. The security, the sense of continuity, the sense of civilization that was conveyed by Roman architecture was just a given to bankers. Now, if you go to New York City today and look for these banks, you're not going to find many of them, if any, except on Wall Street. Most of these Roman temple banks have been converted into upscale retail stores selling designer fashions or into restaurants. So you'll see the building. Sometimes they still will have the bank name on as a kind of irony, but mostly they are not used as banks anymore. Banks have become far more utilitarian. They're basically just shells to protect the ATM machines from the weather and robbery. So that was one thing, the world of banking, in fact, the world of money altogether. Look at the design of our bills, and you will see Roman ornamentation all over them. Look at the State of the Union message. Next time in January, the president is giving a State of the Union message. He speaks in the House of Representatives. And what do you see behind him? Not an American flag. Well, you'll see one, but that's just a smaller part of it. What's on the wall? Not an American flag. Not the seal of the president, not the seal of the United States of America with the eagle. What is there? A fasces, a Roman symbol. We could say America is emblazoned with a fascist symbol. That's really where the word comes from as well. We are constituted as a republic, not a Greek democracy, but as a Roman republic. The model of American life, the model of the way in which the Senate was developed and so on, and the House of Representatives as well. As we will see, all of this comes out of Roman models which our forefathers lived with very, very strongly. And they saw themselves at the time of the Revolution as Roman heroes, ready to form a new republic over the corpse of the old monarchy. Just as we will see as we look in greater detail at Roman history, the Romans themselves had once done. So the symbolism of Rome is extremely important, and the cultural trappings of Roman life very, very important for Americans to know and understand. I would sometimes get hold of an old textbook from New York City schools. Before 1915, 1916, all New York City textbooks were filled with stories of the great Romans. It was felt if a young person could understand those and live with those, he would be a moral person, strong character, and patriotic. Following World War I, that started to fade away. And by the end of World War II, in which Italy was an opponent of the United States, references to Rome and evocations of Rome as a model for proper behavior basically came to an end. And of course, there's a similar history of things German as well. If we think that before World War I, one-third of America's citizens could speak German fluently. That's how strong German families and German cultural influence was in this country. And now, especially if you teach in a Waldorf school anywhere near New York City, sometimes the grandparents aren't even being told that the children are learning German, and German is also disappearing as the foreign language of choice from Waldorf schools. So we see things fading away, but Rome is still very important, and its specter, its ghost, as Steiner said, lives very, very strongly in American life, in the life of the modern world altogether. If you make your way to New York City, perhaps with your class or just yourself, look at the major older buildings in the city, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in particular, which is the jewel and the crown of New York's cultural life. It's created in Beaux-Arts style by Sanford White, at that time considered America's greatest architect, and it's based on the design of Roman baths, and you really see the life of Rome there. The campus of Columbia University, same architectural team, worked on it as well. And there, once again, you see Low Memorial Library, again, a Roman bath style with Roman temples arrayed around it, the various libraries and other buildings of the original circa 1900 to 1910 campus. So it lives on. It lives on in our nation. It lives on among us. So there we have not only the astral needs of the developing youngster, but also the social cultural needs of our time. They're still there. And in fact, as the first Gulf War waged and I was teaching grade six, I was telling my students, well, it's great, you know, America comes in and seems to win a war, but as we learn from the Romans, conquering is one thing, occupying and ruling is another. And it's interesting that in the wake of the very disastrous wars that America has fought in the first decades of the 21st century, how many books have been coming out about Rome? What we have to learn from the Romans, good and bad, and how we in so many ways are going through a developmental path which remarkably seems to be modeled by what Rome went through 2,000 years ago. So all of this will also be of great importance for our students. And lastly, Roman history is for many boys the first historical study that really speaks to them. And this is, of course, the Romans' aggressiveness, their remarkable organization of warfare, their engineering. These things awaken many boys for the first time to a real enthusiasm for what they're learning. And that's no small thing. That's very important for us to work with. So we'll go on and look at what we try to cover in the study of ancient Rome and some of the ways in which we can take up this great mass of material.